Okay, Mr. Page, you have 15 minutes. Would you care to reserve any after rebuttal?
I would, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Okay, you may begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, my name is Andrew Page, and I represent the appellant, Jerneel Moody. I'll explain why this court should reverse the circuit court for Greensville County. Essentially, Your Honors, this is a case where the circuit court, in reliance on the Commonwealth's argument, is saying that what's good for the gander is good for the goose. And this type of case, and the facts of this case, is essentially a breaking and entering of a home where one of the group members testifies that the intent of the group is to steal valuable items and to sell those items. They go into the home, they grab a laptop, video games, a television, they grab a big jar of coins, and also one of the folks in the group grabs keys. Now, obviously, at this point, the jury and the trial court has determined that Jerneel Moody is the person who has done this. But through this stealing of things in the home, the keys are picked up in the same residence, it's a one-floor ranch, essentially. It's a one level. The pictures are in the record. And he goes and takes the vehicle from the same residence. Doesn't take it separately. Instead, some of the items that are actually taken from this impulse, or from this same theft, are put into the automobile and driven to a Saquon Tyler's residence.
Counsel, what you're arguing is essentially the single larceny doctrine. And in this particular case, one of the Confederates basically testifies that their intent of stealing was basically to get portable things that they could, in fact, very quickly sell. And they named off a list of things, which did include the automobile.
Yes, Your Honor.
How is the single larceny theory applicable under that particular factual pattern?
Well, because this court in Richardson laid out the rule that the primary factor in looking at in determining whether the single larceny doctrine applies is the intent of the thief. Now, essentially, the Commonwealth and I guess the ruling of the court in denying my motion to strike and the renewed motion to strike is that the intent of the Confederate is replaceable for the intent of the particular thief.
Is there anything in the record that does not make that a reasonable inference?
Yes, Your Honor. I would suggest that in the record, the fact that these items are then put into the vehicle without objection from any of the Confederates, none of the other members said, oh, wait, we weren't supposed to steal the vehicle, too. We were only supposed to steal these video games, these laptops, these televisions. We weren't supposed to steal a car, so let's put these items back where we had them and leave the car here. There was no objection by the Confederates. Instead, it was all made part of the single impulse. And the part about the ambiguity.
When does the impulse form?
Well, I would say the impulse formed at the time that they decided that they were going to enter into the home to steal the items.
And at that point in time, would it have been a reasonable inference that the group was planning to steal items that they could dispose of easily?
Perhaps, but the distinction would be that at that particular time, nothing had actually been escorted. Nothing had been taken. And the taking has to be concomitant with the intent of the thief. So the actual takings didn't occur until they came into the residence. And so when the aspirations were occurring, they were all occurring within the residence. And as they were picking up those items, they also then, or the appellant, according to the trier fact, picked up the keys at that point, moved the vehicle so that all of the Confederates and him could then put the items into the vehicle, which were escorted collectively to the Saquon Tyler's residence. And while the facts of the case are in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth because they did win the case at trial, in Richardson, this court noted that when it comes to the application and enforcement of the single larceny doctrine or of any criminal law, any ambiguity should be ruled in favor of the defendant and against the Commonwealth. So I think that burden of that standard of review is applicable here. Because, as noted, there is some ambiguity as to what does valuable items mean. Now, to this particular person, it meant only these things. But that's the only inference that we have. We don't have any testimony to say what the intent was of the remainder of the group or even of the appellant.
And where's the ambiguity if that's the only evidence we have?
Well, the ambiguity is in the fact that when they went into the home and they took all these items at the same time, they also took the keys took the vehicle, and they all collectively put these items into the same automobile as part of the same impulse. So the ambiguity would be, well, if they were only there to steal these type of items, why would they then agree to put all these same items into the vehicle in the same taking? And looking at the AC factors that this court laid out in AC versus Commonwealth, all of these factors weigh in favor of using the single larceny doctrine. The location of the item stolen. This was the exact same location. It wasn't like there were multiple floors. It wasn't like there were multiple residences. This was all at the same location. There was no lapse of time between the taking. It was during this exact same time frame where they were all in the house taking these things. The general and specific intent of the thief. Again, you can't transfer. This isn't a larceny by mob. You can't transfer the intent of some other group onto the thief. And it's the Commonwealth's burden to prove what the intent of this particular thief was, not relying on what one of the other person's intent was. And then looking at factor four, the number of owners, well, these were all the same owners. It was the same household. And number five, whether intervening events occurred between the takings, which there were none. These all occurred at the same time. Now, the Commonwealth tries to rely heavily on the fact that after the items were taken to Saquon Tyler's home, the vehicle was then transported to some field. Well, it doesn't matter what happens after the fact. The issues are this. What was the intent at the time of the taking and the aspiration? What occurs at the time? It doesn't matter what happens with the subsequent items. As I argue in my brief...
For determination of intent, can't you use anything that occurred and that comes into evidence? To make a determination as to intent?
Yes, Your Honor. You can certainly infer that for purposes of criminal intent, but for the specific intent of determining an impulse of the thief who took the automobile, don't believe that the court can then infer from the other actors that this was some sort of separate impulse. The Commonwealth relies heavily, I live in Franklin, so forgive me if I butcher the way this is pronounced, but Segastume, I don't know if that's...
Segastume.
See, I knew I would butcher that.
It's all good.
They rely heavily on that case, and the fact is because it does involve the taking of an automobile after a theft, but some important facts are left out of the Commonwealth's brief in that case. Number one being that the initial taking of some items occurred on May 4th of 1996. 2 days later, on May 6th, 1996, the thief comes to the residence, hits the lady on the head, drags her out to the woods, attempts to rape her, takes a watch and keys to a cottage, says, "I'm going to wait for your husband to get home." 10 to 15 minutes later, she escapes from the bonds that she's in, goes to another place, calls the police. The first one was 15 to 20 minutes. This one, 10 to 15 minutes after the call, the police arrive on scene. And then see the defendant in that case get in a Volvo and drive away and attempt to elude. The difference between that case and this case is that there was the jury could have found that there was some time that elapsed between the taking of these items and the taking of the Volvo. Because, obviously, the purpose of the defendant getting in the Volvo at that particular point was to evade the police. We don't have that.
Can you infer the fact that they made the same determination as it related to the automobile, they were simply just trying to get away?
But the key point would be they. That would then show that it was their agreement to engage in that single impulse.
Rather, I should say the appellant, because only the appellant got into to the vehicle.
Well, that may be the case, but with the appellant didn't get the items into the vehicle alone. The record said that they put the items in there. So, again, it would still be with the agreement of the group. So it would still suggest that it was part of that same individual impulse to take those items. It wasn't like there was some lapse of time. The keys were taken while the items were taken. And I argued in my brief...
Can't he individually change their collective plan by taking some action that they didn't contemplate?
They certainly could change their intent, but then we would need to look back again at the AC factors and weigh those factors and say, geez, was it still the same location? Was there any lapse of time at all? This is all happening at the same time. This isn't, for instance, like in the Richardson case, the court reversed the aspects as to the two purses where one purse was 10 feet apart and the defendant had to walk around a wall essentially to get from one purse to the next. They said the single larceny doctrine does apply here. But the other part of that case that was affirmed at the panel hearing by the en banc hearing was the fact that if they went to multiple floors, they went to multiple buildings, those did constitute separate and distinct transactions, even though the person had the intent to steal the exact same type of items. So essentially, the reverse argument here. In this case, they were trying to steal valuable items to sell. And it's beyond dispute that eventually this vehicle was offered to sell for parts at a body shop, as noted by both Mr. Sexton as well as noted by Mr. Parker. So I think that looking at these factors, it completely differentiates from that case that will remain unsaid. And going back again to the second argument is the fact that the court relied on the credibility of these witnesses. And again, I understand that the purpose of the trial court is to determine the credibility and facts of the witnesses. But in this particular case, none of the Commonwealth witnesses' stories essentially added up. Miss Hamlet was the primary witness, the star witness, so to speak. She was told prior to giving her statement that her fingerprints were found. So she knew the jig was up. She knew she was in trouble. She needed to give someone up. She didn't want to give up Mr. Tyler. She didn't want to give up Mr. Harris. So she gave up Mr. Moody, who she knew but didn't know as well as her other two friends. Mr. Sexton is the person who lied to Mr. Parker by the Commonwealth's own testimony by saying that the vehicle was his grandmother's, put the plates on the car, and essentially did all of the talking. So basically, the court found that Mr. Moody was guilty because he was present for these transactions and based on the testimony of Ms. Hamlet. And I believe that decision was plainly wrong because it didn't exclude all reasonable hypothesis of innocence. For those reasons, I would ask the court to reverse the Greensville County Circuit Court's decision and dismiss all of the charges. In the alternative, I would ask the court to dismiss the larceny of the motor vehicle and remand for new sentencing. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Virginia Tyson for the Commonwealth. I think it's important to talk about the standard of review in this case, because this court, over several opinions in recent years, has said the standard of review in determining whether it's multiple larcenies or a single larceny is the same standard of review for sufficiency of the evidence. The evidence is viewed in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, and unless the determination is plainly wrong or without evidence to support it, then that decision stands. That's Denos. A couple of unpublished opinions were extremely, exhaustive in their discussion, Tanner and White. But I will note that Tanner cited to Bragg, which is the church embezzlement case. I believe that was the right one. In any event, looking at the facts under this standard of review, the sufficiency of the evidence standard of review, the evidence does support that there was more than one larceny. This was not a single larceny. And I thought the record was clearer than this about where they put the items in the cars. I understood, my recollection was they put some items in the truck and some in the car. The best I can come up with on short looking is on page 117 of the appendix, where they're back at the house and they're taking the items out, and the response from Ms. Hamlet is, "We took everything out the cars." So at least she refers plural, that they didn't just put everything in the Suburban, but they used both of the cars to transport. I think it's very important in this case, unlike many, that we actually have affirmative evidence on what the intent was. I think that's somewhat unusual in a case like this. But the intent, as presented in the testimony to the court, was that the intent was, the plan was to steal items easily sold. And I would say that the 1998 Suburban was not easily sold, as is evidenced by the fact that it went from Moody to Sexton to Parker to Robinson. This was actually a very difficult transaction. The trial court perhaps said it best, as he understood that what the witness meant was at a pawn shop, but easily sold on the street. The items that they wanted to find were TVs, laptops, guns, and money. The items that are easily sold, not the automobile. So there was no plan to steal the car, according to this witness. There was no discussion of stealing a car, according to this witness. And that is affirmative evidence that's in the record. And so there is evidence in the record. The court was not plainly wrong in denying the motion to strike one of the two larcenies.
Ms. Kaisel, what's your response to counsel's point that it was a Confederate's intent and not necessarily the appellant's intent.
No, the Confederate's testimony is what the group planned to do, not what she alone planned to do, but what the group planned to do, and he was part of the group. She identified him as part of the group, and certainly the evidence supports that, and maybe I'm dipping into the second issue just a little bit, but the testimony from the witness was that one of the witnesses said that, I guess it was Sexton, where he said that Moody told him that the guns had been thrown in the creek, and lo and behold, when the state police dive team went to look, they found some of the guns in the creek. Also, the Suburban wasn't found in the woods where it was noted to be, but the police found the original license tag and the registration card from the Suburban in the place in the woods where the police were notified that it would be. So the group intent is borne out. And certainly, Ms. Hamlet, as even defense counsel argued at trial, was incapable of stealing all these things by herself. Apparently, the jar of coins was quite huge. They put it into a baby stroller and brought it out. And so there was a group effort. And the only testimony before the court was that the group determination or the plan was to steal easily resellable things. And the Suburban does not qualify as an easily resalable item. Now, as to Sagastume, I think Sagastume's facts are incredibly close to this, and why I think that is true, or at least the analysis from that case, was that the court noted that the various items, the watches and jewelry, other personal property, occurred inside the house. And the purpose of stealing those items was to sell them, or possibly, in the case of the rifles, to use them for protection. But the stealing of the automobile, of the Volvo that was there at the house in Sagastume, was to transport the defendant away from the scene. And whether he stored all of his items in the car or not, I don't know. But this case is quite similar. And really, even Richardson is. In the Richardson case, of course, there was a single larceny as to the purses at the nurse's station. But there was not a single larceny as to the items that were taken on different floors at MCV or other buildings at MCV. The most important factor, and this court has said it a number of times, when looking at all of those factors, the most important one is whether there is a single impulse and that it is part of the general scheme. It's an and test. It's not an or test. Is there a single impulse for taking these items? Is it part of the same general scheme? Well, the general scheme and plan here was to take items that were easily saleable, which was what happened at this house. They were looking for a house. They weren't even looking for this house, according to the witness's testimony. But this is the house they chose. And so, just so happened, there were some keys there at the house. The defendant in this case then took the car. He then drove it away. I think looking at items that happened after the fact can be something that the court can do, because I think it underscores that this was not part of the original plan, because all of the other items ended up at Tyler's house so they could resell them. This Suburban automobile ended up in a different place. And as I mentioned before, it eventually, I think, was sold for its engine, but it took quite a bit of maneuvering and movement before that could be done. So it's our position the theft of the Suburban was not part of the initial impulse to steal. It was not part of the original plan. And that according to the cases that this court has decided in recent years, that this was not subject to the single larceny doctrine. The court was not plainly wrong in finding there was more than one larceny, and there was evidence in the record to support what the trial court found. With regard to the sufficiency of the evidence, essentially, the argument is that the witnesses were not credible. And I've always thought this is interesting, that in McNeil, the Supreme Court actually says that an appellate court is incompetent to decide on credibility because the appellate court does not have the opportunity that the trial court has to measure demeanor and to view the witnesses and to hear their intonations. And thus, unless as a matter of law, the witness is inherently incredible, the appellate court defers to the factual findings as to credibility of witnesses. And in this case, as I mentioned a little bit before, there was some corroboration of these witnesses, but I also think it's very important that whatever benefit these witnesses were going to have from their testimony, the fact finder was aware of that. And in fact, the witness was questioned. For instance, the woman was questioned about the benefit to her of having her case completed in the juvenile domestic relations court as opposed to being tried in the circuit court. I think that Mr. Parker, Jermaine Parker, who was involved in the sale of the parts for the Suburban, had charges pending, and he had no promises. I think Mr. Sexton, who was involved in some of the aftermath, also, the fact finder was aware that he did not have any charges. So the issue of credibility was squarely before the fact finder in this case. And the fact finder determined that the witnesses for the Commonwealth were credible in their determination. The jury determined that the evidence supported the convictions. And so because there's no inherent credibility as a matter of law, then the credibility has been determined and the fact finder was not plainly wrong and its determination should be affirmed by this court. So for the reasons stated and those on brief, we would urge this court to affirm the judgment finding that there were two larcenies in this case and the burglary. Unless there are other questions, we would ask for affirmance.
Thank you, Pam.
Thanks.
Okay. Welcome back. 3 minutes.
Thank you, Judge. I was wondering if I got her time too, but I have two brief points. Number one, jumping on the argument, I didn't get a chance to say this in the first one. I tried to, but the jar of coins that was mentioned by the Commonwealth just a few moments ago, that's not an item that will be sold at a pawn shop. In fact, the record indicated that that item was taken to a separate location by Saquon Tyler and someone else to, I believe it was a grocery store or some sort of store where they essentially fed the coins into a machine and it pumped out cash money for them. So it wasn't something that was going to be sold. So, I mean, that it goes to show that their intentions of things of what they wanted to do was basically fluid. I mean, it was, let's go in, let's steal some things, and let's sell some stuff.
But you would agree that cash or coinage is easily disposable.
Sure.
Not traceable. It's not significant in terms of size. It's simply easy to spend or otherwise convert to something that you want.
Yes, Your Honor. It would be goofy for me to argue otherwise, and certainly don't want to be, you know, disingenuous with the court. But the bottom line is the keys were something that were easy to grab. They were in the house, in the same residence, same location. And I didn't hear any argument relating to the AC factors and how they apply in this case, other than saying that we're looking at the general scheme and intent of the group. Again, the second point being, the most important factor isn't alone the general fraudulent scheme. It's the primary intent of the thief. That's the primary factor, is the intent of the thief. And it's not a larceny by mob. And that's essentially what we're going to have here, is there will be, frankly, I'm surprised sort of that the Commonwealth is arguing this, because this could obviously have implications for the multiple petty larcenies that they argue in these types of cases, where if you know the group comes in and they decide, hey, we want to steal firearms. Well, while they're stealing firearms, they decide to pick up a wallet or two and other things. And instead of being able to argue one grand larceny, the Commonwealth will essentially be hamstringing themselves into saying, well, I guess we just need to keep multiple petty larcenies in this case. I'm actually kind of surprised by their argument, but I see this as a clear application of the single larceny doctrine because of the AC factors, which this court relies on and has relied on for many cases. For those reasons, I'd ask the court to reverse the circuit court's decision.
Thank you, counsel. We'll come down and read counsel now and call the next